Talking History. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of someone who has been called one of the most formidable and underestimated women in Irish history. A remarkable woman whose career spanned the land agitation of the 1880s to the years after the winning of Irish independence. That's Jenny Wise Power. And we'll be finding out why she has been neglected in Irish history. We'd love you to join our discussion. You can send us a text on 53106 and text costs 30 cents. You can also email us talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week we looked at the Battle of Mogadishu and Operation Gothic Serpent, and we debated what really happened in Somalia in October 1993. And if you want to listen back, just go to newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on Jenny Wise Power. Born Jane O'Toole in Wicklow in 1858, she joined the Ladies Land League in 1881 and became a league organiser in counties Wicklow and Carlow. In 1883, she married the journalist John Wise Power, and they had four children, the youngest called Charles Stewart after Parnell. During the split, she supported Parnell and edited the volume of speeches published after his death. A successful businesswoman and campaigner for female suffrage, she was active politically and was a founding member of Cumann na mBan in 1914, becoming its first president a year later. Elected to Dublin Corporation in 1920, she supported the treaty and became a senator in 1922. By 1925, she had become disillusioned with Cumann na Gael and resigned from the party, continuing on as an independent. She retired in 1936 and died in 1941. The historian Anne Matthews has called Jenny Wise Power one of the most formidable and underestimated women in nationalist history. And tonight we want to assess her contribution to Irish history and find out why she has been neglected. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Mary McAuliffe is Assistant Professor in Gender Studies at UCD and is an expert in Irish women's history, gender and war, as well as memory and history. And her books include Richmond Barracks, 1916, We Were There, 77 Women of the Easter Rising. And in January, her new biography of Margaret Skinner will be published by UCD Press, and we're going to have her on the show to talk about that as well. Dr. Margaret Ward is a visiting research fellow in history at Queen's University Belfast and the author of the highly acclaimed Unmanageable Revolutionaries, Women and Irish Nationalism. And her new book is Fearless Woman, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Feminism and the Irish Revolution. Dr. Sarah Ann Buckley lectures in the Department of History at NUI Galway and is an expert on the history of marginalised groups of women and children, as well as the social history of Ireland in the 20th century. And she's the author of The Cruelty Man, Child Welfare, the NSPCC and the State in Ireland. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Dr. Anne Matthews, the historian, author and playwright, whose books include Renegades, Irish Republican Women, 1900 to 1922, and Dissidents, Irish Republican Women, 1922 to 1941. Mary, I might begin with you, and I might begin with the impressive range of things that Jenny Wise Power was involved with. The Ladies Land League, the suffrage movement, Cumann na mBan, Sinn Féin, Cumann na Saoirse. She was a successful businesswoman. She was a councillor. She was a senator. She was involved in many other things as well. First of all, it's a remarkable career span. And I kind of think that if this was a man we were talking about, they would have had numerous biographies about them, and they would be studied as a way of giving an insight into the range of Irish history over this period.
Absolutely. When you think of the life of Jenny Wise Power, her activist life, her political life, it begins when she's a young woman with the Ladies Land League in 1881, and it ends with her opposition to the 1937 Constitution, the draft Constitution, and all in between. If there was any nationalist or feminist organisation, Jenny Wise Power was part of it. And not only was she part of it, she was on the executive, or she was a founder member or a co-founder member. But she wasn't just involved in feminist or nationalist organisations. She was also involved in politics, political organisations. She's very important in Sinn Féin. For instance, she is one of the people who stops funding to the Republicans after the split in the treaty and makes sure that none of the Sinn Féin monies are going to Republican activists after 1922. And she's very important in that. She's in Dublin Corporation, as you mentioned. She's on the board of Guardians. She's on the board of Grange Gorman. She is involved in many, many things, and also a very, very successful businesswoman. And it's almost exhausting to think about what she was doing. But obviously, although she was the mother of four children, she did have help in the home that enabled her to conduct her public life. So you look at somebody like Jenny Wise Power. There is one biography that was written in 1991 by Marie O'Neill. But since then, we've gotten access to new sources. And while Jenny Wise Power, unfortunately herself, didn't leave a big archive, we now have more sources that we can rewrite and reread her life. And you're right, all things being equal, if she'd been James Wise Power, she would be in the history books. Absolutely. She would be central to the history books. Any history of Sinn Féin, any history of the split after the treaty, because, of course, she's a founder member of Cumann na Saoirse, any history of the politics of nationalism, of feminism between 1900 and 19 and the War of Independence. All of those histories would have her in them, but they don't. And we have to ask the reason why. And it's because she's a woman.
I wonder, is it also because she doesn't quite, she was an uncomfortable fit in some of these, because she was saying things that they didn't want to hear. Like, for example, when she was in Cumann na Gael. So it's difficult for them to claim her their successor, Fine Gael, because again, she was speaking out for things in terms that she didn't approve of that they were doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she could be a contrarian voice, but she knew where she stood. And this is a thing, perhaps, that people don't recognise, that women didn't go into politics simply because their husbands were involved, or their brothers, or their fathers. And oftentimes we look at political women who succeed in politics because maybe their father died and they get a seat in the Dáil, as happened throughout the Irish Free State and into the Irish Republic in its early years. Jenny Wise Power had an ideology herself. She developed her own politics. She moves from being a constitutional nationalist and a Parnellite after the Parnell split to a militant nationalist, then to a pro-treaty in Cumann na Mban. I mean, she was in a minority in Cumann na Mban, but stuck to her guns, is an unfortunate term, but stuck to her ideology. And then when she's a Cumann na Gael senator, she's absolutely horrified at the anti-woman legislation they're introducing, and can't believe that men whom the women had fought beside are doing this to women, contrary to the promises of equality in the 1922 constitution. And she makes no bones about standing up and saying it. So she is that sort of voice that is necessary, that we need to look at, that, you know, that the state didn't come into being without these contrarian voices, not just from anti-treaty men, but also from women. Like, here is a pro-treaty woman who's still taking on Cumann na Gael in some of its politics.
Very good. Margaret, it is a remarkable career. And can we go back to the Ladies Land League and her involvement there, and her friendship with Anna Parnell, with Charles Stuart Parnell, and even after the Ladies Land League was disbanded, that continued?
It did. And she's only about 22 when she becomes involved in the Ladies Land League, and very quickly becomes an executive member. And I think what's admirable about her is she's not simply somebody who works in the office in Dublin. She goes down to Carlow to the eviction. There's about 50 people being evicted. There's very little she can do to stop that happening. But what she's there to do is both to challenge the forces of law and order, and also to look for alternative accommodation for the people who have been turned out of their homes. And she manages to accomplish this for quite a few of them. And she also was the one in charge of sending books in for the prisoners in Kilmainham Jail. I think one of the things that she is meticulous in terms of administration, and this is obviously a key trait of hers throughout her political career, and one of the reasons why she is always a committee member or treasurer of so many different organisations, that she was one of the ones responsible for the Ladies Land League Book of Kells, you know, that very famous big ledger that they developed that that looked at each area of the country, what the landlord was like, what the spirit of the tenants was like, what kind of rent was being paid. A lot of the Ladies Land League papers were entrusted to her, and it's unfortunate that when her house premises were targeted by the British after the Easter Rising, that all of those were lost, which is one of the reasons I think we have so little to go on in terms of building up a full life of her. And she was a loyal woman. I mean, I think one of the reasons she supported the treaty was her loyalty to Arthur Griffith, who had been a friend of hers for decades. She was loyal always, as you say, to Charles Stuart Parnell. And also, I think, felt there was a lot of hypocrisy in terms of politicians' attitude to Parnell and his divorce. I think she was a broad-minded, tolerant woman. And that's one of the reasons why she didn't see a reason not to continue giving him her support. And yes, she maintained contact with Anna Parnell. When Anna comes back to speak for Sinn Féin in the by-election, she and Jenny Wise-Power are still there, still on cordial terms. Anna speaks to a meeting of suffrage women in 1911 when she's over, and Jenny Wise-Power is one of the ones who continues to be there at the meeting, and straddling, I think, that uncomfortable sometimes space between nationalism and suffrage. She was a strong suffragist as well, although that's something not known about as much about her. She was a strong friend of Hannah Shee Skeffington, for example, and both of them together resigned from the Haslin organisation, the Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association, in 1906 over the fact that that organisation was very pro-unionist. And after that, she, although didn't join the Franchise League because she felt she couldn't be in something that put suffrage before the national question, she still supported suffrage prisoners, fed them from her restaurant, supported Hannah Shee Skeffington when she lost her job, and said that there was should be no contradiction between women fighting for citizenship and demanding an Irish Parliament.
And Margaret, it's interesting, she was a vice president, became a vice president of Sinn Féin in 1911, and then was not only a founding member of Cumann na mBan, what became its first president in 1915?
Yes, indeed. And Elizabeth Bloxham, who was at the founding meeting of Cumann na mBan, talks in her witness statement about that time when Cumann na mBan was being formed, because, you know, in November 1913, the Irish volunteers are saying very vaguely there'll be work for the women to do, and nobody knew, did that mean that women were going to be part of the volunteer movement, were they going to have a separate organisation, or were they were just going to be rolling bandages and collecting funds without any organisation. And there was obviously a lot of controversy behind the scenes, and from what Elizabeth says, it's Jenny Wise-Power who really seizes the initiative, talks to key women involved in the nationalist movement, and over a few months develops what becomes Cumann na mBan, and so, you know, is there at the inaugural meeting in April 1914 after the split with Redmond over whether or not they should support the war effort. After that, they kind of reorganise as the kind of militant organisation attached to the Irish Volunteers, and she really was the person to have been given the presidency, and so it transpired. She was the driving force behind it, and she had the moral authority and the solidity behind her to be able to have negotiated, I think, between the volunteers, who had differing views at that stage on the role of women, and talking to women and bringing them along with her and trying to make sure that she had women like Agnes O'Farrelly at that inaugural meeting, women who would be seen as being moderate in order to try and attract as large a constituency of women as possible.
Sarah Ann, I want to talk about some of the other groups she was involved in. For example, Inini na hÉireann, because she also played a significant role in that.
She does, yes. And even how that organisation is formed. So it's really formed out of a response to the visit of Queen Victoria and what's known as the Patriotic Children's Treat. So she is a co-president, and it's very feminist, it's Republican, it's frequently quite socialist, and I think as an organisation, it really matches a lot of her own interests over the years. So when it came to the cultural revival, how important the Irish language was and became to herself and to her husband, John. And even though that organisation is merged later on with Cumann na mBan, it is quite radical for the time that it is there, and particularly in its use of, I guess, cultural activities. So they put on plays. A lot of it is propaganda. They also have an involvement with the Abbey Theatre. They have street protests. And this direct action is a part of it. And I think the involvement there shows a bit more even of her radicalism, but also how central she is to this organisation, as with so many. You wonder often where she got the time while also having businesses.
And let's talk about 1916 and the signing of the proclamation, because there is one story that it was signed in either her business or her house.
Yes, so it is reported that it is signed in 21 Henry Street, which is the Irish Farm and Produce Company, which she opens in 1899. It's really, or like to me, it's quite fascinating. It's a shop that sells Irish produce. Also vegetarian food. It's very central to a lot of the cultural activities of different groups. Now, by 1916, she has four other businesses, but it is reported that the proclamation is signed in 21 Henry Street. And herself and her daughter, Nancy Wisepower, are really, you know, they're carrying provisions and her witness statement, Nancy Wisepower, describes this up until Wednesday of Easter week. They're bringing provisions. She's so central to that side as well of the activities of the week. And as a place, if we think about networks and we think about, I guess, how different organisations cross-pollinate, that premises, 21 Henry Street, is really quite important and, you know, quite progressive as well, I think, in its business model, as well as all the political activities.
Very good. And Mary, after then, she's elected to Dublin Corporation, I think 1920, and you see her again continuing to play this significant role.
She is. I mean, like a lot of the women, she gets involved in collecting for the Republican Dependence Funds after 1916 and is involved in reorganisation. She does step down as president of Cumann na mBan and allows Markievicz, or Markievicz takes her place. But of course, Markievicz is such a name at that stage. She becomes treasurer of Sinn Féin after the German plot arrests. So again, she's central to the reorganisation of that, of politics as well. And she is, as Margaret said, she's very effective in as an organiser on the corporation. She's part of the Finance and Public Health Committee. She's governor of Grange Gorman Mental Hospital. So she has varying interests and varying involvements. But it doesn't mean that she doesn't take her own standpoint as well. For instance, she was very upset with Arthur Griffith that he supported the Irish Parliamentary Party's vote against the Conciliation Bill. prior to in 1911, and then that she was very upset with the Irish Parliamentary Party, even though she would have been a constitutional nationalist at one phase in her career when they wouldn't allow suffrage into the 1912 Home Rule Bill. And indeed, in 1918, she canvasses for Countess Markievicz in the St. Patrick's Ward. And in a report in a newspaper in the Irish Times, I think I saw after the election, she indicates that the women's vote went mainly to Sinn Féin in a sort of revenge against the Irish Parliamentary Party because of their failure to include suffrage in the 1912 Home Rule Bill. So she's very effective in this period as well, the sort of those years between the Rising and the War of Independence, and she's very much involved in that phase as well. And of course the next phase of her life is when the treaty is signed and the treaty debates begin.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Dr. Anne Matthews about Jenny Y's power as an activist and campaigner and why she's been overlooked in history.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Hagan, as we debate the life and legacy of Jenny Y's power. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Anne Matthews, who's an historian, author and playwright. Her books include Renegade, Irish Republican Women, 1900 to 1922, and Dissidents, Irish Republican Women, 1922 to 1941. And I have to say that Anne has been the inspiration for tonight's show, because when we did our show on Constance Markievicz, we were talking to Anne afterwards, and she said, you know what, we really needed to do a show on Jenny Y's power, that this really was an extraordinary story and something that our listeners would enjoy. And we took Anne up on that and decided to make a show of it. So Anne, welcome back to the show, and thanks for giving us the idea.
Thank you very much.
Now, what is so extraordinary about Jenny Y's power? You describe her in your book Renegades as one of the most formidable and underestimated women in nationalist history. And I think she's underestimated because people don't know her story, and they don't know that it's a story that covers so many of the great moments of history at that time.
I find sometimes you will say to someone, well, what about Jenny Y's power? And they say, who? And I find that difficult to deal with, because Jenny Y's power was active for 60 years, three generations. The Irish Press, De Valera's paper, when she died, there was an obituary, and they talked about her being active in the generations. And she was so important. She was a doer. She worked. She didn't go looking for notice. She just got on with things. She was a suffrage. She was suffrage. She was Republican. She was nationalist. And she was an entrepreneur. And she was very, very successful at that, because she was the breadwinner in her family.
So in many ways, she was way ahead of her time.
Absolutely. She's more than 100 years ahead of her time. And if there was a biography published of her now with that material in it, current young women who are entrepreneurs or in politics would find someone that they could identify with.
What do you think were her strengths as an activist and a campaigner?
Well, she was born in Wicklow in the 1850s, and her first that we know of was when she got involved with the Ladies Land League, and she was secretary of the Ladies Land League. And then she moved from there into supporting Parnell and the Irish Party. But she was clearly an immensely intelligent woman. And when she married John Power, the Wise was added later, when she married John Power, and he was having difficulty getting full-time work, which is a background we won't go into right now. And so she started her shop, and she ended up owning three shops. And she was a grafter. But while she was doing this, she was involved in the Dublin Suffrage Association. She was involved with the Gaelic League, the Celtic Literary Society, and the Celtic Literary Society gave life to Inian na hÉireann. And it was not Maud Gonne's organisation. The source was the Celtic Literary Association. And so she's involved in that. And then Arthur Griffith, when he founded Sinn Féin in 1905, she is there. She's a member. There's no issue. She becomes treasurer. So she is active in politics before many of the women we're talking about now, if you don't mind me saying. In the early 1890s, when Markievicz and Maud Gonne were trawling Dublin Castle for a husband, she was out there and active.
Controversial indeed.
Yes. Now,
Anne, can you tell me about, I suppose, her views then on the revolutionary decade, her involvement in the events of that time? Did she support the struggle for independence?
Oh yeah, she was a founding member of Cumann na mBan, when it was restructured in 1915 and they restructured the executive, she was elected president. She was the first president of Cumann na mBan. She was president of the organisation in 1916. And she was active in supporting her shop in Henry Street. She lived above the shop, or was the go-to place to meet other Republicans or nationalists, depending on how you describe yourself. And it was the go-to place, and it was being constantly watched by the police from about 1911. And she was active in organising events through the Irish language, encouraging the Irish language. She was a founding member of the Irish School and Ring in Waterford. So she was proactive in encouraging the idea and the activities of Irish Ireland, and then was involved in the political by 1914, 1916, post-1916. In the excitement of 1916, and her daughter died in July 1916. So in that year, the members of Cumann na mBan voted Countess Markowitz as president. But Jenny Wise Power was active. And then when the second Sinn Féin was formed, along with Kathleen Lynn, she was responsible for making sure in the constitution that it was open to everybody, that women had an equal part. And without those two women, that may not have happened. And she is very, very important. By 1921, she's treasurer, co-treasurer of the Sinn Féin party. And then when it fell apart in 22, and there was the split, and then with De Valera, she refused to give him the money. He demanded the money. She refused to give it to him, and she placed the money in court. Which led to a very interesting other story, which doesn't concern us today. So she was a woman who knew her own mind, but she was steady. She didn't do extremes. She just took the road she took, had her opinions, and moved with them, and didn't look for attention, just grafted and worked away at it.
And based on what you're saying there, is it the case then that she supported the treaty? Was she sceptical of De Valera?
Yes, she was sceptical of De Valera. She was... when it came to the treaty debates, her letters on the treaty debates are very, very interesting. And she was caught in, I think it's one of the few times to read the letters and see the emotion. This woman now, who has now been over 50 years involved in this, is now looking at something coming down the road that's not going to be nice. And she very much reminded me of, I was listening to someone this morning talk about Boris Johnson, and they were saying there are people who think he has this up his sleeve, he has a rabbit and he's going to produce it at the last minute. Jenny Wise Power said that about De Valera in 1922. You know, so she was very astute, very, very clever lady.
Talk to me about her role then in the Irish state after independence. I get the sense that she was a little disillusioned, and certainly at the way she certainly wasn't treated as well as she could have been.
Yeah, I think after the foundation of the state, she had been in terms of politics, she had been elected guardian of the North Dublin Union. She was a governor of the mental hospital in Grange Gorman, so she was involved in politics at local level, which fed into her national politics. And then she became senator of Free State, Irish Free State. She became senator, but by the middle 20s, I can't remember exactly what year, she became disillusioned with Cumann na Gael, and she declared herself an independent. And then she battled constantly, to go into the old debates is interesting. She battled constantly in the 30s, I think, when they were talking about, restricting women's lives in industrial work, not the professional, industrial work, and that they wouldn't, to prevent women having overtime. She is concerned, and the words she uses are, her concern is for women who will do this work, who are married or unmarried, who do this work and will do overtime because they are poor and they need it. And those are the words of a woman who really knows what she's talking about. And she lived in Henry Street, above that shop, for possibly 20 years, up to the early 20s. And she was surrounded by the tenements in Moore Street, the poverty in Moore Street. It was on her doorstep, and she knew. And she knew what she was talking about. She didn't do the lady of the manor stuff. And she knew exactly what she was talking about. And she's there, and she's fighting for women to enable them to stay in work and earn money to feed their children.
So how do you think history should remember Jenny Wise Power?
Well, she was a leader. She definitely was a leader. And I think she should be remembered with pride. Forget the nationalists, forget the politics. I think we should remember this woman with pride, who gave so much over 60 years to Ireland, to women, and to, I don't like using the cause, but the cause at the time. And she was very, she was formidable. And the interesting thing is, there's a 2014 stamp for Cumann na mBan, and she is on that stamp, totally by accident, because there's a photograph of a lady with a coachman, and she's Mrs. Redden. And obviously that was, it's an attractive photograph, but walking directly behind her are three women, and one of them is Jenny Wise Power, and the other one, whose name, her name escapes me, but Jenny Wise Power is one of the three women walking behind it, and nobody picked up on, there she is in that photograph and in the stamp. So she is on a stamp, but it's completely accidental, because they were going for the glamour image. If you look at that stamp, you see the glamour image.
And in a way, it kind
and she
of,
didn't do the glamour stuff.
And it kind of encapsulates the story of her life, you know.
Yes, it does.
A major contribution,
yes,
but overlooked. I'm struck by what you said at the beginning about her being an inspiration, and would be a greater inspiration if more people knew her story.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, she married John Power. He had been sacked for his fiend activities. He was having difficulty getting a job. And she now had children, married with children, and she started the business, and she had another shop in Camden Street. And what she did was she sold only Irish produce. So she bought the vegetables and whatever from the farms around County Dublin and in Wicklow. That was before its time. And she advertised her shop, Irish produce only, and then had the little cafe and did very, very, very well. And that in itself is before its time. I mean, to see, when I first saw the advertisement for the shop, when I was doing my research, long time ago now, and it struck me, you know, in my lifetime, buy Irish became a slogan. But here was this woman doing this way back in 1910, 1911.
I'm curious why you think she has been forgotten by history. Do you think it's because she was a woman and therefore there was an attempt to write her out because of her gender? Or was it because her views were uncomfortable and it made people a little nervous and that they saw her as a threat because of that?
Well, the rise of women's history, the momentum for women's history in the 1980s, and we're looking at the historians, and the historians are coming from a particular perspective, as in feminist, through the lens of feminism. It was before we used the word gender, through the lens of feminism, which I totally understand, because I was a young woman in 1969. I totally understood it. But because she took the Free State side, she's dismissed from those works. She is mentioned, and then she disappears, almost stage left, and she's gone. And I think it's immature to do that. Because when you look at the attendance at her funeral, De Valera, the whole Fianna Fáil government, the total opposition, Mrs. Pearce, Kathleen Clark, who all disagreed with her politically, were very proud to go to this woman's funeral and very proud to say that they were friends of her. And yet we have this history. And in 2014, the most outrageous omission is in 2014 when the commemoration of Cumann na mBan was held in Glasnevin, and it was not held at her gravesite. It was held at Lisbeth Farrell's gravesite, who was not a member of Cumann na mBan then. And Jenny Wise Power's grave is every bit as close to the gate as Elizabeth O'Farrell's was, but they choose to do it. It was in the wrong place. Elizabeth O'Farrell was not involved in 1916 when Cumann na mBan, and they totally wrote her out of the story by having the President and the ladies of the Defence Forces lined up at Elizabeth O'Farrell's grave instead of Jenny Wise Power's. That was outrageous.
And possibly, though, with more to come in the decade of commemorations,
yes.
her time might still come.
Yeah, and I did complain to a certain minister, but... Yeah,
but perhaps with tonight's show, Jenny Wise Power will be restored, and the next time she has a stamp, it will be
Jenny
directly in her honour.
Yes, yeah.
And it will say Jenny Wise Power. Well, my thanks to Dr. Anne Matthews, author, historian, and playwright, and the inspiration for tonight's show, bringing the life, the legacy of Jenny Wise Power to life. My thanks, Anne, for joining us tonight. We'll be back with more on Jenny Wise Power right after this break.
Is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Jenny Wise Power. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Mary McAuliffe, Dr. Margaret Ward, Dr. Sarah Ann Buckley, and earlier there we heard from Dr. Anne Matthews. Margaret, can I talk about maybe how effective Jenny Wise Power was as a campaigner, or indeed how effective she was working with others? What can we learn from looking at her different engagements with, say, Cumann na mBan or a time on the corporation, or later when she was a senator?
I think what we get, and in fact I'd like to just go back to when she was a poor law guardian, because she was there from 1903, just after women won the right to be poor law guardian. So what's interesting, she wasn't simply campaigning for legal reform, she also, when it happened, you know, put her money where her mouth was. She actually went and got elected and was there as a poor law guardian for 8 years. She didn't simply act in that capacity, but she became a very strong critic of the workhouse system and gave a really excellent lecture about it. She talked about it being radically, essentially, and irretrievably bad, and then talked about the sort of reforms that would be needed. For example, children should never be in an institution. You know, people who were destitute should be given some kind of outdoor relief, etc. And she wanted to get rid of the workhouse system. So what she was laying the foundations for a modern state that would look after its citizens at a time when people were really not looking at the sort of the nuts and bolts. A lot of people who would have been campaigning for national independence wouldn't have been thinking about the lives of people in that kind of detail. And so she was somebody, I think, who had a real sense of herself, who really understood all of that. And Hannah Sheehy Skeffington says that when she was elected to Dublin Corporation, she was there. There were five women, and Hannah was one of them. Hannah says she remembered Jenny Wise Power's first act, which was signing her name in Irish on the roll of councillors, and the town clerk disallowed it, but she fought and won her point. So, you know, she'd been a member of the Gaelic League from its inception. She was a strong supporter of the Irish language movement. Her daughter, Nancy, was the Irish language correspondent for the Irish Citizen. So she was somebody who just was just so true to herself all the time. I think that that's really what I'd like to say about her.
Very good. Mary, let's talk about Cumann na Saoirse. What was that, and talk to me about her involvement there?
Well, Cumann na Saoirse is the organisation that was set up by the pro-treaty women once Cumann na Mon split. And of course, the majority of Cumann na Mon, certainly the executive and the broader membership indeed, were anti-treaty. But Jenny Wise Power, I suppose harking back to her constitutional nationalist beginnings, actually saw the treaty in the same way Colin saw it, as a stepping stone to independence, as something that wasn't fully what they wanted, but as something that would allow them begin that process of gaining full independence. And she said that it was right and proper that Irish women should publicly declare their allegiance to the Free State. And I think Jenny Wise Power was somebody, once she decided she was going on that road, and once she decided where her allegiances were and her loyalties were, she stuck with it. So she resigned from Cumann na Mon, and you have to remember she's a co-founder of this organisation, and she and others like Alice Stopford Green, Men Ryan, who was at that time married to Richard Mulcahy, and various others set up Cumann na Saoirse. And they actually began the campaigning for the acceptance of the treaty in the June election before the other organisations, including Cumann na Gael, got started. And they really begin the propaganda campaign, and they issue a leaflet and they give six reasons why you should vote for Cumann na Saoirse, or for the treaty rather, in the election. And they were determined that it would be shown that not all women were against the treaty, and that the noisy faction, as Jenny Wise Power called them, in Cumann na Mon would be shown to be not all of Cumann na Mon. And interestingly, reflecting back on what Margaret said, Jenny Wise Power then later on, you know, this was a bitter split, and Cumann na Saoirse get the unenviable reputation as Cumann na Searchers when the Cumann na Mon women are being arrested and imprisoned, and they're part of that. But later on, when Jenny Wise Power was a senator, she was able to cooperate with old Cumann na Mon members in various activisms and various campaigns they had against some of the anti-women legislation that was introduced by both Cumann na Gael and Fianna Fáil in the 1920s and 30s. So she was somebody who could stick to her beliefs and go the hard road, really, like leaving an organisation she had founded, but also didn't remain very, very bitter. And I think it's a little bit untrue to say that feminist historians don't look at Jenny Wise Power. They do. She's been very much part and parcel of the study of women's activism, republicanism and feminism for the last 40 years. And certainly Margaret would have written about her and various others, because she is that important to the story of women's politics, feminism, activism, national and local politics, social activism, social welfare activism. And I think she actually needs a new biography is probably the best thing for Jenny Weisbauer.
Sarah Ann, she had a very interesting 14 years as a senator then, with Cumann na Gael, leaves them, becomes disillusioned with them, time as an independent, I think was with Fianna Fáil in her final 2 years. And she was involved in some really important work as a senator, including being on the Carrigan Committee.
She was, yes. And as I suppose Mary mentioned there, she actually is really quite a good opponent to a lot of the legislation that we would now see as being quite discriminatory towards women. So the Juries Act, the Civil Service Bar, and obviously her role in regards to issues surrounding the marginalisation of children. So Margaret mentioned the Poor Law. The Carrigan Committee being a very, you know, very important and probably in regards to legacy, something that hasn't been addressed that often in regards to her career. So I think that even though, yes, she has a very broad sweep of interest, to me, her politics is very much about more female participation. And I think that does come through, even just in the fact that she sits as an executive member on so many of these organizations. And, you know, she sells her business in 1929. And there are a few years there when it's her political career. And I guess there's the legacy also of her daughter, Nancy, who is very active in a number of campaigns, in particularly establishing Republican press offices during the War of Independence, and it has herself a very long career as a civil servant. And I think that legacy there, that intergenerational legacy, you can see that. And why, I think as Mary said, there just does need to be a new biography is probably the best way of viewing this. But she does come through in so many places. So I don't think that it's the case that it's probably just amalgamating all of them again and reassessing her role, because she is mentioned in so many parts of Irish history for her activism, her politics, her feminism. And I think, you know, great idea to do the programme.
And Mary, it's interesting that you mentioned earlier that, I think at the start of the show, that she opposed De Valera's constitution, the 1937 constitution, which is extraordinary because by that point she was representing Fianna Fáil in the Senate. So it's, she didn't mind who she went up against if she didn't agree with things. And was it because of the women in the home sections that was that what bothered her?
Well, yes, you can see it throughout her Senate career, like when she opposed the Civil Service Amendment Bill, which would stop women taking exams to climb up the ladder in the civil service. She saw that was against the right of equal citizenship in the 22 Constitution and not in the interests of women workers. She opposed the Juries Bill because it was against the civic spirit that was developing in women and felt that it would be a backward step. She opposed the Conditions of Employment Act because it went against the fact that equal rights again were guaranteed and they couldn't be equals in a state that said you couldn't work in certain places. So her opposition to the 1937, the draft 1937 constitution and the Women in the Home Bill is just a continuation of that, because again it's chipping away at the right of women to be equal citizens and the right of women workers to take their place in Irish society. And so you can see a steadiness there in her politics. She remains true to her own politics, her own ideologies, and she'll collaborate with women. So a lot of the women she might have split with on the treaty are now her allies in that campaign against, unfortunately failed campaign against the 1937 constitution. And of course, we still have that Woman in the Home article in our constitution to this day.
A lovely text in from Orla on 53106 saying that tonight's show is the most interesting so far and that she always enjoys the show, and some nice other ones like that as well. Margaret, we're almost out of time. It's going to be hard to try and capture her legacy in a few sentences, because the legacy is essentially the history of Ireland over these decades.
It is. I'm just reminded of what Tánaiste Skeffington said, who
you know, remained a strong friend of hers. And she said at the end that she hoped that that there would be somebody who would talk and write about women who helped in the fight for freedom. And in this record, she says, the name of Mrs. Wise Power will have an honoured place. And I think, as Mary and Sarah Ann have said, we all have talked about her when we've written, because you cannot avoid her. She is there, as we've talked about for the last hour, in so many areas. And I think what now with historiography, we have more sources than we had. And I think that there is time now for somebody to do full justice to somebody who had such a wonderful and self-sacrificing career, who put everything into the fight for Irish freedom and for women's freedom too.
Mary, we are almost out of time. Do you think she died happy with the Ireland that had been created, or do we not have the evidence?
Well, if you look at her campaigning, obviously she wasn't happy with a lot of the legislation that was coming in. But I would hope and I would think that she herself would have died happy knowing that she did her best. She put in all of her energies in fighting for Ireland, for women and for the rights of workers. And nobody could ask any more of somebody.
Well, I think that's a perfect note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Mary McAuliffe of UCD, Dr. Margaret Ward of Queen's University Belfast, Dr. Sarah Ann Buckley of NUI Galway, and we also heard from Dr. Anne Matthews. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who helped put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, well, we are going to have our monthly book show. We are going to start with the history of the city-state of Boston. We're going to explore the Russian house where Soviet dissidents were put in to live after they fell out of favour. And we're going to find out about the radical writer James Baldwin and more indeed. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.